Somebody asked me what I did when I was standing out here earlier, and I could give them the corporate answer of starting a company, but what I really do is investigate murders. And that turns out to be a fascinating job. Our podcast is our independent investigation into that.
More than half of the U.S. population over age 12 has now listened to a podcast, according to Edison Research. This trend has fundamentally altered the landscape for audio programs, liberating and empowering both listeners and creators.
And it's so liberating because if you have a host who's a woman and she's funny, she will suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous sexism in the critiques. And it's so freeing as an editor to say, this show isn't for those people.
And so you got, for the first time in my 20-year career, second-by-second data. It was amazing to see for the first time when you wrote a joke and it worked, when you wrote a lead and it worked, and more importantly, when you did something and it didn't work and begin to dig into why.
The business of podcasting is coming of age as well, but there remains an economic gulf that some entrepreneurs and investors see as an opportunity.
The monetization ecosystem in podcasting is really stunning. The entire industry today is worth about $500 million, whereas radio is worth about $17 to $19 billion. So there's just a huge gap in how much engagement you're seeing in podcasting and how much monetization is happening.
I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop, and on this special episode of the GeekWire podcast, we're going meta. It's a podcast about podcasting, featuring highlights from my discussion with podcast producers, media veterans, and startup entrepreneurs on stage at the GeekWire Summit.
Many of you started in traditional forms of media. What has podcasting done for you in terms of opening up the canvas on which you can paint these audio shows?
Here is Phyllis Fletcher, the senior editor for podcasts at American Public Media, who has worked on shows including APM's hit business podcast, Spectacular Failures. You may recognize her voice from her previous work as a reporter and editor at KUOW Radio in Seattle.
I feel like I can paint for a specific person, almost. I've gotten to participate in some exercises where you get to envision, who is this for? And also, what are they doing? How are they using this? Are they using it on their commute? Are they using it when they're shopping for dinner? You get to really put yourself, you know, use, like, project your empathy into the person that this is for and want to grab that person specifically. I love that.
And has that changed the way you do things when you compare it to your career in radio?
It changes everything from, I mean, marketing is a thing. Marketing was anathema to public radio for decades. It was just like, we don't do that. And now we do that, especially in the podcast space. You have to, you know, thinking about the art, the theme song, you know, that you want it to grab the person and communicate to them, this show is for you. And a lot of times in public broadcasting, we would be told, okay, now, you know, talk to a person when you're voicing your story. But, you know, everything else about the story was about, like, okay, this is for everybody. Like, we want everyone to be interested in this. So it's a different way of orienting yourself towards anything you want to make.
Next up, Steve Henn, who leads content strategy for audio news at Google. He is a journalist turned entrepreneur who left a career in radio to co-found a digital media startup that was acquired by Google in 2017. You might recognize his voice from his work in public radio as a correspondent on such shows as Marketplace and Planet Money.
I think that one of the things podcasting and digital distribution allows you to do that's really different from broadcasting, which is where I started, is that it allows you, and you talked about this, to speak to much more diverse audiences. If you think historically about, like, who public broadcasters spoke to, like, there's a stereotype, right? We basically know the 15 to 30 million people. They tend to be college educated, they're disproportionately white, and it was public broadcasting, but it was leaving out 80% of the public. You can see shows that have relatively niche audiences gain national traction and really grow. And, you know, this still sort of fits into the public broadcasting genre, but like 99% invisible. It's a show about design, right? You couldn't sustain that show in any major market in the country because the audience wasn't big enough. But when you launched a specific niche national show, you have an audience of, you know, it was 100,000 and 200,000. It's probably now about 500,000 an episode. And that's sustainable. That works as a business. And so the diversity of content that digital distribution supports is much wider. And I think, you know, as a former public broadcaster, I look at public broadcasting's mission, and I think it allows public broadcasters like you to reach much, much more diverse audiences than they have historically by actually marketing those stories to those communities and speaking in their voice to those listeners.
And it's so liberating because, you know, especially like if you have a host who's a woman and she's funny, she will suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous sexism and the critiques that are directed towards her voicing and her very existence. And it's so freeing as an editor to say, this show isn't for those people.
Here's David Payne, the president of Rainstream Media and the co-creator, author, and executive producer of its flagship show, Somebody Somewhere, a true crime podcast. A lawyer and former federal prosecutor, David's career in media has included roles as chief digital officer for Gannett and USA Today, and senior vice president and general manager of CNN Digital.
When we set up this panel, I think, Todd, you said, David, you can talk about traditional digital media. And I had that moment where, oh my God, digital media was traditional. And the thing that was so eye-opening for me about getting into the podcasting realm after coming from CNN and Gannett and USA Today, we had so many failures in how we first got into this genre. So when the iPod came out and the iPod Touch, you know, God, we were on it at CNN. You know, we put out new episodes. We put out essentially what you think headline news. We did. We cut all the news segments. We decided we had to be funny. So we created, stood up a unit that did funny news segments. Every one of those failed. Every one of those, nothing stuck, nothing. And it wasn't until, and I had this epiphany when I listened to Serial, which was, it was first-person storytelling that changed the genre. So you could go into a news story and then say, I believe, I wonder, I think, I'm not sure, which was a complete game changer. And I think with podcasting, because it's such an intimate thing and it's in your ears, it's a diary type of format. And so that's been the biggest eye-opening thing for me as a content creator.
Our final panelist is Amira Valiani. She is the CEO and co-founder of Glow. That's a Seattle startup and Pioneer Square Labs spin-out that's building a subscription, monetization, and distribution platform for podcasts. Amira served as a communications advisor in the Obama White House and as a speechwriter for then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Amira got started in podcasting with her own local politics show in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
One of the things I really love about podcasting is, as a former speechwriter, you know, we used to really aim for what is that zinger line going to be? You know, we used to write and think, like, what is the thing that is going to be on the news tonight? Because that is the message that we need to communicate. So you're telling, you know, this immense story in a 30, 40-minute speech about something complex like American leadership, but really you're thinking, what's going to be the 30-second clip that gets carried, you know, on CNN tonight? And what's beautiful about podcasting is you can actually get someone to stay for the entire 30 or 40 minutes. And so, you know, what I did with our local news podcast, which is how I got my start, you know, I used to live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I decided to report on the city council election there. 26 people are running for city council. So you're like, how do I message to the voter how they can choose among these people? So we interviewed every one of them, and, you know, we were able to condense it down into a 6-episode series where we sort of help people walk through the election. And it was amazing as we got people at the tail end of it who said, you know, I listened to every one of those episodes, 5 or 6 hours of really rich information on something as nuanced as a city council election, and that helped me become an informed voter. And before, you know, what you'd try to do is try to get someone to pay attention to a paragraph on a flyer, maybe go to your website, but this way we could actually get these people to communicate their messages for minutes, hours, to the audience that really mattered. And that's what's really amazing is you can capture people's attention for an extended period of time in a way that other forms of media don't necessarily allow for in the way they've evolved.
All right. To get a sense for what this can sound like, here's a highlight from Spectacular Failures, the American Public Media podcast edited by one of our panelists, Phyllis Fletcher.
In an instant, the click of a shutter, perhaps, the company that pioneered the snapshot, that put a camera in every hand, that reshaped our understanding of the visual world, was basically gone. It's easy to think that Kodak collapsed because of the advent of digital photography. And you'd be partially right. But that's far from the whole story. because it was Kodak that invented the digital camera in the first place. That should have put them on solid footing, but it didn't.
I love that this medium allows for an entire podcast about failures.
Yeah, that was amazing. I was really excited to get to do that as my first project. And I've been tweeting, amazingly, while I've been up here, with the hashtag GW Summit, and I tweeted a link to that. So, and many more messages will go out about just some of the things that we'll be talking about this hour.
Now that is some epic multitasking. You can see the show notes for those links and also for Phyllis's tweets. But next up, take a listen to this report by panelist Steve Henn from back when he was with NPR's Planet Money podcast.
Back in 2007, when Barack Obama was running for president, he stopped by Google headquarters. And it's sort of a joke, they asked him one of Google's notoriously tough interview questions.
What is the most efficient way to sort 1 million 32-bit integers?
Obama might have been fed the answer.
Well, I think the bubble sort would be the wrong way to go.
Obama talked about using big data to make government better. Dan Soroker, this engineer sitting in the back of the audience, was smitten.
So, Steve, there's a backstory to the clip that we played of yours, and it involves A-B testing.
Yeah, so I did that when I was at Planet Money. It was actually the last NPR podcast that I did. And when I was at NPR, our tech team had created an app called NPR One that allowed people to skip stories really easily. And so you got, for the first time in my 20-year career, second-by-second data about how your story was performing, and you could compare it to norms. And we actually wrote two leads to that story about A-B testing. And the lead I liked was not the one you heard. It was about how it was really frustrating to be overruled by your boss, you know, the highest ranking person in the room, and the data was going to break you free of that. And my boss, my editor, was like, no, that's a crappy lead. We should use this Barack Obama story. And we fought about it. And then we decided, since it was a story about A-B testing, to actually A-B test it. And much to my chagrin, he was right, which is horrible. But it was the first piece of radio that I'm aware of that actually used A-B testing to begin to gauge what worked and actually use that to inform the editorial choices we made in the podcast itself. That's one of the things that I think is really interesting about this space. In the last 4 years since that was made, there's been more data. Spotify makes good data available. Apple's making more data available. At Google, we are working aggressively to make more data available for podcasters as well. But as a reporter who worked in this space for years, it was amazing to see for the first time when you wrote a joke and it worked, when you wrote a lead and it worked, and more importantly, when you did something and it didn't work and begin to dig into why and make your work better.
David, tell us the story of somebody somewhere.
Somebody asked me what I did when I was standing out here earlier, and I could give them the, you know, the kind of the corporate answer of starting a company, but what I really do is investigate murders. And that turns out to be a fascinating job.
Somebody somewhere, an investigation into the assassination of Assistant United States Attorney Tom Wales.
Have a nice day.
Sounds like him.
Wow. And did he confess?
No.
Maybe because he didn't do it.
Here is a behind-the-scenes tidbit for you. My colleague, GeekWire co-founder John Cook, actually played a role in leading David Payne and his colleague, Jody Gottlieb, to choose the case that they decided to investigate on the first season of their podcast, Somebody Somewhere.
Somebody Somewhere started when I met with John and Todd one day, probably 2 years ago, and I said, you know, I'm new to Seattle, I'm trying to figure out, this podcasting thing looks pretty interesting, but I'm looking for a story. I really want to find a cold case. I'd been a former federal prosecutor and had some experience in doing that. And you guys mentioned the murder of Assistant United States Attorney Tom Wales, which I knew of in the recesses of my mind, but hadn't focused on it 20 years. It's an unsolved, it's the highest profile murder case in the Department of Justice. It's the only federal prosecutor who's ever been assassinated in the line of duty, if in fact he was assassinated in the line of duty. And our podcast is our independent investigation into that. It turns out that this case, which is simple on the facts, you know, somebody walked up to his basement window and shot him through his daylight basement window. That is the story of the murder. But turns out it's the most complicated case I've ever seen or been associated with. The FBI, after 18 years, has 51,000 separate folders on the case, each of which represents an individual lead. And so they have created three times the amount of documents in that case than the Enron investigation, which is the largest white-collar criminal case. So it is a crazy story. It was a great one to land in, so I thank you guys for the initiative. And you need to listen to the whole season to find out who did it.
That's right. But there's a case to be made, and I know you would probably be careful about stating cause and effect, but your podcast and the reporting that you've done has at the very least kept this top of mind among the public, and there's also a case to be made that it has pushed the prosecutors to do more than they otherwise might have.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that based on the timing of events. Last year, Rod Rosenstein, who was in the middle of dealing with the Trump-Russia investigation, flew to Seattle to assure the public writ large that they were working hard on the case. Coming out of that meeting, there was actually a woman who was put in a grand jury 1 week after that. That's the woman who was arrested just about 8 weeks ago. So
Not under suspicion of the crime, but under
suspicion of lying to that grand jury after Rosenstein came out about conversations she may have had with a hitman. I think that's one of the other interesting thing about this genre. It has the capability of driving the news. You're not just telling a story about it something. You become a part of the story and you drive action.
All right, but is there a viable business in all of this? That's coming up next in our special podcast about podcasts on the GeekWire podcast.
I wanted a career in IT, but I didn't know where to start. WGU makes it simple. Their accredited online degree programs cover all kinds of IT specialties, and they have valuable industry certifications built in at no extra cost. The payoff? Having those certs back up my degree makes me look even better to future employers. A nonprofit university that includes top industry certs in their programs? I choose WGU. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
What are you seeing, Amira, in terms of what breaks through from a marketing perspective, from an awareness perspective, and then from a business perspective as well? Big question,
that's a doozy.
Maybe let's focus on, what are you seeing that works?
So I think the most interesting thing that we see that works in podcasting, which is sort of counterintuitive, is this focus on the niche audience that works really well. So I previously started a local news podcast. I also had a podcast advertising business. And one of our most successful podcasts was one called First Mondays, which was a show about the United States Supreme Court, hosted by two former Supreme Court clerks who every Monday went deep in the weeds of what was going on in the Supreme Court. And they were using legal jargon. It was the kind of thing that was only decipherable if you were a lawyer. But they found this rabid base of lawyers who loved their Supreme Court classes in law school and now were off working on transactional law, but just loved staying engaged. And they did enormously well because they had a small audience that was limited in ceiling, but just loved listening to them every week, would call in with questions. And so advertisers would line up to try to get to reach these people and tell them, you're a lawyer, you need to tell the time, so here's your movement watch, or you need a good night's sleep, so here's a mattress. And so the thing that we're seeing that works really well in this medium is being able to find an audience that wants content that's very specific that you can deliver to them. And those are sort of the most interesting ways we're seeing. And we see that sort of across the board in law and fitness. I got off the phone yesterday with a podcast about how to run an auto shop. And so what's really interesting is how this medium empowers people who have niche audiences to really try to build their business and be able to reach them individually.
I do think you touched on the biggest issue, which is discovery and monetization and how those connect. Because I think one clear learning, at least so far as the independent podcasting universe, is ad-supported media is not going to work. And I think some of the stuff that you guys are doing is important to that cause. So
thanks for the plug.
So let's take it in order, actually. I'll get back to the monetization in a second. Tell us about Discovery. Can you explain what you're doing in your role at Google, Steve?
Yeah, sure. So the first thing I'd like to say is that I tend to agree that ad-supported monetization in audio isn't going to work. And I think, you know, coming from Google, that's a noteworthy thing to say, right?
Yes.
So I'm really bullish about direct listener revenue. I think, you know, it's worked in the public media space, and I think it is the way that passionate people can support the voices that they want. But I think one of the fundamental problems in the podcasting ecosystem today is Discovery is broken. The dominant platform is the Apple Podcast app. Huge props to them for building this ecosystem. But Discovery on that app is difficult, right? You have to know what you're looking for by name. And so what we're doing at Google is trying to open up a bunch of new discovery mechanisms. And we're doing it in a couple ways, but they have one thing in common. We're opening up the MP3s, the audio files, and we're transcribing them and indexing them. And so just recently that's made podcast search possible. You can search for a topic in search and write podcast after it, and we will give you podcasts about that topic. So we could search for your case, hit podcast, and you'll get that. Or you can search for a podcast about your public radio doppelganger and get a podcast by them, or a country music singer, and you can get a podcast about that person. So we have a long way to go to make that search better. Those signals when you transcribe an audio file are imperfect, but I think it's going to get better and get better quickly. The other thing that is missing is that sort of surfing discovery mechanism. What's the equivalent of thumbing through your Instagram feed in audio? It really doesn't exist. And so if you look at what drives a lot of radio listening historically, the biggest shows with the biggest audiences have tended to have a format of shorter form stories, under 10 minutes long, that cover a lot of different categories. That doesn't exist in podcasting because you have to press a button to start every podcast, or you have to, you know, plan out your playlist. One of the things we did at our startup and one of the things we're testing now at Google is personalized short form playlists that really could act as a discovery mechanism. So stories that are under 10 minutes long from a variety of publishers with an opportunity to actually dive deeper after you hear that story. And again, we are indexing that, we're making it searchable, we have an understanding of what your interests are, and we try to match those. At the same time, creating sort of a story arc that makes sense, right, that delivers surprise. If we can begin to break open the discovery challenges, so people can find niche communities that they're interested in, and we can combine that with some of the solutions that you're proposing around direct listener revenue, you could see the podcast ecosystem go from what is it now, like $500 million, to grow to something that rivals or surpasses what radio is today, which is in the neighborhood of $17 to $23 billion, depending on how you count it. So there's a huge headroom for growth here, and that's just in the US.
So let's talk about what you're doing to connect that audience with the podcaster in a way that can provide a monetization model. And I think what Glow is doing is interesting, in part because it also is part of this broader trend of subscription versus advertising revenue. Amira, if you could just sort of explain what's happening and how it fits into what you do.
The monetization ecosystem in podcasting is really stunning because if you think about it, as Steve said, the entire industry today is worth about $500 million, whereas radio is worth about $17 to $19 billion. So there's just a huge gap in how much engagement you're seeing in podcasting and how much monetization is happening. And by and large today, most monetization happens through advertising. But you're starting to see the growth of a couple of other monetization channels. So one is licensing. So some of the biggest podcasts out there are able to get TV and movie deals, but these are still few and far between, although we're seeing more and more of them. And then there's direct revenue. And what was really shocking to me, or interesting to me, as I started my own local news podcast, is we're able to get, you know, a really steady stream of people listening to our show, but it's a community, right? So it was never going to be big enough on a volume basis to make significant revenue via advertising. And it's not that we were averse to advertising, but it just wasn't going to be enough to pay the bills. And so what I set out to do is I said, let me build an MVP. Like, let me test to see whether or not we could build a subscription local news business out of this podcast. And as I turned to do it, I realized the tools just weren't out there. It was really, really difficult to do, to build a paywalled podcast or even a podcast that was supported via direct listener revenue. The closest I got was putting up a Squarespace page where people went and contributed. And as I talked to other podcasts, I found that they were facing similar issues. They wanted to get direct listener support. Listeners told them they were willing to pay them, but they just didn't figure out an easy way to do this. And so that was the birth of Glow. So now I'll walk through sort of what Glow does, which is we want to make it really easy for podcasts to be able to create a membership model. And we do that by working cross-app, so we don't make people sort of married to one app. So the way it works is if you're listening to this podcast, listeners might hear you. This is acquired. They have two regular episodes a month, Seattle-based podcast. They say for $5 a month, click on the link in the show notes, and you can become an acquired limited partner, which means you get access to two bonus episodes a month where you can understand, you know, what is going on in VC. Pay super quickly, which is a problem in podcasting. We use Apple or Google Pay, so we don't need people to create a login or anything like that. It takes you to a list of podcast players. You hit Apple Podcasts if that's where you want to listen. And then you go back to your player, and you see the bonus feed right next to the regular feed. And so now, quicker than I could even explain it, you see the bonus episode appear right next to the regular episode in your feed. So Acquired, that was our first client. They implemented this system about 10 months ago. And what did they see? Well, like I said, they used to issue two regular episodes a month, solely advertising-based, and now they have two bonus episodes a month that are supported via direct monetization. If you look at the unit economics per listener, on an advertising basis, Acquired makes 93 cents a year per listener. That's advertising alone. Now, if they can convert that listener to a subscriber, they're all of a sudden making $60.93 off that listener. So they've been able to expand the margins that they are able to get off that one listener dramatically. Now, even if you amortize that over all their listeners, their unit economics on average per listener today is about $4. So they've been able to quadruple the amount that they make over all their listeners by instituting direct monetization. And we're seeing that grow over time. And this is a model that's still early, but we're seeing expand incredibly rapidly in podcasting. And I think you'll see more and more of this habit of wanting to support your favorite podcasters or even being willing to pay for content.
One of the best parts of discussions such as this at the GeekWire Summit is when the panelists themselves start learning from each other. Here's David Payne of the Somebody Somewhere podcast wrapping his mind around the possibilities and also the limitations of what Glow CEO Amira Valiani just described.
You know, you can force some bonus content, but the cream of the content is going to go into the primary feed. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that. Have you had any success in making that work in broader storytelling?
The most interesting sort of examples of this are a lot of people point to China, and there it's really common for, let's say, someone to issue the first chapter of an audiobook or a series free, get people hooked, and then get them to pay for the rest of it. And so we're just starting to see the beginnings of these models happen in the US, and we're starting to test with a few of them, but we're still waiting on results. You know, what's great is we can help people experiment with what works, and we call that helping them find content market fit, right? What's your audience want? How do you build a business around them?
I mean, in a true crime podcast, you can imagine a scenario where they drop the first 11 episodes of Serial and are like, hey, for a dollar, you get the final episode, right? Now, that could really backfire,
that could,
right?
The ransom approach.
But it's those kinds of experiments that I don't think we've been able to do and are certainly worth doing.
Yeah.
I like that. I am a person who, you know, like I Patreon some podcasts and I'm like, oh, if only it was that easy as what you just showed. So I think that's really cool what you're doing.
What I'd like is to have the spectacular failure of the event in my life. So I would subscribe to Spectacular Failures and become a member, and then you would come out and document just a disastrous weekend. How about that?
I got you. Okay. All right. That sounds like fun.
I think we would all subscribe.
Yes, yes. I know many people in my family who would. So do you see opportunities day to day to create customized content for super fans? Because that's essentially what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm on the consumer side of some of those. You know, like I said, so there's this podcast. You'll get the link to it later if you're following me at the event hashtag here at GW Summit. One of my favorite types of podcasts is like the like buddy in your phone, like the chat podcasts. And there's this one I subscribe to about D-list celebrities called Who Weekly. And they have a whole separate feed that you can Patreon at $5 a month. And it's the stuff that super fans would eat up. It's just silly. It's like over the top, ridiculous. And I feel like there's, you know, anything that creates that affinity like that, you only want more. So I feel like when it doesn't create an ethical hurdle, because the editor in me is thinking about, like, okay, if you were to do a true crime one, but there was a paywall for one episode, that could create some ethical and legal problems that you would not want to grapple with. Yeah. But I think that for things that have that strong affinity thing, and when it's all fun, that would be amazing.
Can you believe we've gotten this far without talking about Amazon's Alexa and other smart speakers? That's coming up next.
How are smart speakers changing what you do, how you think about things? Are you, as you're envisioning the person listening to the shows, thinking about somebody listening through Alexa or Google Assistant versus in their ears?
I think smart speakers allow a couple things that are really interesting to happen. People tend to listen when their eyes and hands are busy and their minds are curious. And so a lot of the podcast product design that's gone on has keyed in on visual cues. Like, that's where you make your decisions. And it's really hard to do when you're going for a run or you're cooking, right? And so being able to seamlessly ask for what you want and get an answer is potentially game-changing. The other thing that I think is really exciting is it opens up the possibility for interactivity. When I was at Planet Money, I always wanted to ask our audience, what are the worst financial decisions you've ever made? And then just roll tape, right? And I could take the rest of the year off. And so creating these moments where you can be the voice in someone's ear, it can be incredibly intimate, but they can actually interact with that experience, is potentially groundbreaking. There is no platform out there today that really allows producers to seamlessly and easily create those choose-your-own-adventure experiences or to enable interactivity, but I think we're on the cusp of that. And I think when we get there, people like Phyllis are going to have a field day.
Oh, yeah. Steve knows. I've been champing at the bit on this for a while, but I think it was a couple of years ago I started asking my employers, whoever I was working for at the time, like, are we getting into this space? You know, I want to be there. And I was always met with this, opaque wall. So I could not ever quite tell what was going on for my company in that space. But I'm very eager to do it. Everyone I work with knows that I want to get into that. And it's partly inspired by just seeing how my son interacts with his smart speaker. He wants it to do more. And I would love that. I would love to be in that space. It would be really fun.
On a technical level, I think one of the issues is if you compare the web to RSS feeds, right, they're really different. And the amount of interactivity that's possible on the web with hyperlinks and being able to actually jump from one document to another, that doesn't exist in RSS feeds as they exist today. If you think about what we're doing at Google by transcribing, one way to look at that is we're making a fake web doc in the background. And so I think there's a way to go forward here that could create an open ecosystem for more interactive audio that would be really interesting.
One thing to note, though, is it's still incredibly early with smart speakers. So I haven't looked at the numbers recently, but a surprisingly small percentage of podcast listening happens on smart speakers. I want to say it's in the single-digit percentage points. And so there's still a lot of innovation to go, and a lot of it has to do with trying to figure out the right way to promote interactivity with your smart speaker in a way that's just harder than it is on your phone.
Okay, but should you start your own podcast? Service providers, entrepreneurs, marketers, all sorts of people are launching their own shows as side projects or promotional initiatives. So what should you know if you decide to join them? Here's American Public Media's Phyllis Fletcher on that question.
I feel like no matter what you're doing, you have to know why you're doing it and who it's for and how they're going to use it. And you also should know when to stop. How am I going to know this isn't doing what I want it to do? So I think there are creative, content-driven ways to think about that. There are business-driven ways to think about that. But you shouldn't, as an entrepreneur, just feel like, oh, God, I have to be in the podcast space, too. I have to do a podcast. You have to think about, you know, why, who is this for? Like, there's a podcast about elevators. Like, if you stan elevators, I'm sure that that's, like, your show. But he also might, the host might know, okay, how am I going to know this isn't working anymore? You want to ask yourself those kind of questions without just feeling like I have to, because it's kind of like feeling like you have to have a blog like in the 90s. You know, no, you don't. You know, but you should know why you want to be doing this.
If you did want to get into this space, know that you have to come in with a vision of a story and telling a story. I think any good podcast brings you into a story that's independent of what they're trying to tell you. and it involves characters and people. And so if you just put out a podcast on how to, you know, run an elevator up and down a building, if you were the elevator operator, right?
That's not what it's about, though.
That was a slight dig. No. But it has to be about us. You have to tell a story.
Yes.
And it's the character-driven that drives that, as opposed to the how to do whatever it is.
Absolutely, yeah. It's about elevator news. So things that go wrong with elevators. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I did a podcast that compared elevators to self-driving cars.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah, but I think audience acquisition is huge, yeah, right? Like, yeah, knowing where your audience is going to come from and how you're going to get it, because discovery is still broken. Google is still a small player.
And I wish that Amazon, for all the Amazon people out here, right, one of the things that is missing in podcast discovery is customer ratings, in the sense that discovery can be sorted and filtered by customer ratings. Right now in Apple, it is just top charts, but not associated with customer ratings. That's a huge miss. For somebody to step up, and maybe to your speaker thing, maybe there's a way to tell me the highest rated podcasts of blah, 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 blah.
Or if the top charts, and who knows how they put them together, included, right, like completion rate for the podcast, right?
Right.
Like,
word.
To your point, Steve, I know a tech company that has a podcast player and does discovery and could present results based on engagement and time listened. Is that what you're going to do?
I can't talk about future roadmaps. No, I mean, look, Google is really interested in audio. It's clearly an area that we're behind in, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for us there. The Android ecosystem is enormous, and just getting a great first-rate podcast app installed on every Android phone would do more to expand the market than almost anything else you could do.
I'd be remiss if I did not point out the major exits that took place last year in this space for the investors in the room. Gimlet being acquired, of course, many people know that company through the podcast startup, and Alex Bloomberg with Planet Money Roots. Is this a smart bet? Is this a good place for investors to put their money? We won't hold you to it. No SEC violations up here, but how bullish are you on this space economically?
I'm incredibly bullish. I wouldn't be, you know, placing, you know, sort of my career bet on it. I think there's sort of four different ways you could think about sort of how the market looks. You know, one is content, one is analytics, one is monetization, and one is sort of hosting and distribution where you put your podcasts. And I guess the question is, you know, is content a smart bet for Spotify? And if you look at the economics, it makes incredibly compelling sense for Spotify to place bets on content, because for music, they have to pay out a licensing fee for every stream. When they actually own the podcast content, they can turn all that into margin after they've played sort of the upfront cost. And so I think they're going to continue to make content acquisition bets, and you'll probably see other platforms do so as well.
It also differentiates the product. The music labels are going to sign deals with other places like YouTube. They have. And if Spotify has an Alex Bloomberg podcast that you can only listen to there, you know, that's another reason to keep your subscription.
Whether it's called podcast or not, you know, like now blog seems like kind of an antiquated term, right? Like maybe in a few years we won't be calling it the podcast business anymore, but the business of creating things for people to listen to, I'm bullish on that for sure.
I'm actually super bullish on podcasting as content play, on the sort of the business infrastructure things that you're doing. But beyond that, I think if you look at the history of computing from 30,000 feet, right, we had giant computers, the ENIAC, that filled rooms and that were very difficult to program. Then we got punch cards and the computers got smaller. We got a desktop design like Windows and they got smaller still. And then we got touch screens. And with each step, computing became more ubiquitous and more intuitive. Human beings evolved over hundreds of thousands of years to talk to each other. It is the most natural form of communication for our species. And voice computing has the potential to be ubiquitous. I feel like ultimately this is the end state for computing, and the companies and institutions that really crack that and make this incredibly deep personal content accessible, but also are able to give you sort of augmented reality experiences, so they give you your driving directions and they give you suggestions about where to go. That I think is the future of where computing will go in the next, you know, 20 years.
Can I give you props on one more thing that you guys are doing with your transcripts? Is I feel like something that I've been bothered by throughout my career is that it's accessible only to hearing people. And I really appreciate that you're doing something to make what we create more accessible to everyone. So thank you.
We have a lot of work to do.
Nice.
This is great. Big thanks to Amira, David, Steve, and Phyllis. Thank you all for being
thank
here.
You.
Thank you.
That was Phyllis Fletcher of American Public Media, Steve Henn of Google, Amira Valiani of Glow, and David Payne of Rainstream Media, speaking with me at the GeekWire Summit in Seattle in October 2019. Thanks to all of them for their insights, and thanks to Jenny Cecil Moore for recording and providing assistance on this show. You can find links and related content in the show notes on this podcast or at geekwire.com/podcast. And as a special bonus, no membership required, at least not yet, you can also find links to our panelists' favorite podcasts, which they shared with me afterward. You can find those in the show notes and the article associated with this episode on geekwire.com. Be sure to subscribe to GeekWire in your favorite podcast app. We'll be back next week with our regular weekly news roundup. Until next time, I'm GeekWire editor Todd Bishop. Thank you for listening.